Seamus was gone, and Buster was hungry. There was nothing for him here. Greetings, folks. Keith Tyler here, bringing you the Mystery Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. We're all very, very grateful that you tuned in. Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine and Paul Ryan O'Connor bring us our first story. Seamus and Buster is the title. Buster knew Seamus was dead before he reached the window. He scented Seamus's tobacco and musky soap from his hair, overpowered by whiskey and rotten eggs and metal. The metal meant death. Buster thumped from the windowsill to the office floor. Oh, he hated jumping, even well-practiced jumps like this. His natural grace had fled with his youth, and he'd never fully adjusted to losing his eye. Buster gathered himself, scolded his aching hips, and uncoiled upwards. When he landed, his hind feet flailed in space, and he scrambled for purchase atop the desk. He recovered, but the shame burned. Fortunately, no one saw. Seamus would never see anything again. Buster's eye snagged on the floor. Seamus's hatch door was open, just an inch. Curiosity. Buster deliberately trod through Seamus's blood before jumping to the floor, leaving crimson paw prints behind as he walked to the hatch. He intuited that this was important and everyone should see, even Hader. He tried to pry the hatch the rest of the way open, without success. Seamus was gone, and Buster was hungry. There was nothing for him here, but he couldn't leave the old man. Awkwardly, he squirmed into the human's lap. Buster snuggled as best he could, imagining Seamus's soft voice, his calloused hand idly stroking behind his ears. Buster's sleep was uneasy and did nothing to dispel his grief. Dottie held herself up in the doorframe, stifling a scream. Gareth was at his desk, dead, his gun in his hand. She forced herself toward the body on unsteady feet. Gareth's filthy cat burst from the lap, and this time she did scream. She charged after the animal, swinging her purse, shooing it through the window to the ledge beyond. She hoped the mangy thing fell off to the alley. Dottie tried not to look at Gareth. The poor man. The floor hatch was open, a crack, and it was never open. Dottie knelt and opened it the rest of the way, her fingers straying into something sticky. Concealed beneath the hatch, the door to Gareth's floor safe stood open. Inside were papers and a thick stack of cash, but no jewels. Dottie locked the safe and clicked the concealing hatch back into place. She stood, smoothed her skirt, ordering her thoughts. Someone will have heard her scream. There wasn't much time. Her glance sped around the little office. The radio was on, low and leaking static. Two shot glasses atop the desk, near the empty bottle, her lipstick haloing the rim of one. She ran over her story. It was simple, mostly true. Miss Walker... Oh, it was the clerk from the first floor, the ugly one who eyed her legs when she climbed the stairs each morning. There was a scream, he said. Call the police, Dottie said. Her voice cracked, but that added to the effect. Mr. Stone has shot himself. Humans filled the office, flashing lights that hurt Buster's eye. Hader sat on the couch, a man beside her. They made smoke and traded sounds. Found him like this. Was there a note? Buster watched from outside the window. Seamus's scent was obliterated by the strangers crowding in the office and the too strong rose and jasmine scent from Hader. A man peeked up from where he examined Seamus and froze. He looked directly at Buster, really looked at him, not knowing, but by his demeanor suggested that he could. Buster narrowed his good eye, signaling indifference. The man stepped toward Buster. He was square and smelled like onions. Buster shifted into a crouch. From the window to the alley was a death drop, but he could retreat along the ledge. Onions stopped short, not trying to touch Buster. Respectful. Sounds from Onions. Puss, puss. Buster granted the audience, ready to run. Onions squatted down, making supplicating motions with his fingers. He knew the rituals. He made this sound again. Puss, puss. If the room were not full of humans, and especially Hater, Buster might have stretched or maybe groomed as the rituals demanded. Buster did not want to know this man. He didn't want to know any human ever again, but rules were rules. Sounds from the man making smoke with Hater. Lieutenant Stubbs? Yes, Captain, Stubbs answered. Miss Walker is ready to make a statement, Captain Spokane said. Stubbs stood from where he called to the cat and came over to Dottie, taking out his book. He was a square man and short, but his shoulders were thick, and his notebook disappeared inside his outsized hands. Stubbs asked questions Dottie had already answered, her name, her address, how long she'd worked for Gareth Stone. "Do you have a key to the office, Miss Walker?" Stubbs asked. "Yes, that's how I got in this morning," she said. "When did you last see the deceased?" Another question she'd already answered. "Last night about 8," she said. "Oh, do you normally work that late?" "I was finishing some papers," Dottie said. "Then Gareth, Mr. Stone, came in around 7." "How was he acting?" Stubbs asked. Dottie didn't know how to answer. Stubbs prompted, "Was he happy? Distracted?" "Well, he was over the moon," Dottie said. "He'd cracked an old insurance case. He'd recovered jewels that were stolen right after the war, about 10 years ago." "Did he show you the jewels, Miss Walker?" Captain Spokane asked. Spokane was medium height, slim and exceptionally well-dressed, for a detective, well, or for anyone. He wore his hat all the way back on his head, like Alan Ladd used to do in his gangster movies. Frankie had just taken Dottie to see Ladd in his new picture, where he played an ex-cop and Edward G. Robinson was a gang boss. Ladd still had it. So did this police captain. "You can call me Dottie," she said, wanting to please Spokane. "He had his jewels in a big bifold wallet, about 12. "Where are the jewels now, Dottie?" Spokane asked. I don't know," Dottie lied. Stubbs asked more routine questions while Spokane talked with the lab men dusting the desk for fingerprints. "Blood trail here," Spokane said. "Yeah, I think it was the cat. Tracked in the blood," Stubbs said, nodding toward the cat in the window. "I saw paw prints all over." Stubbs returned to his book. "Now, Miss Walker," he said, "did Mr. Stone have somewhere secure he kept the jewels? A safe?" Dottie didn't answer. Watching Spokane follow the blood trail to the hatch, he squatted down. "There, isn't a safe," she said, caught in between. Spokane pressed the floor, and the hidden latch popped open. He looked at Dottie sharply. "You know, that's a foolish thing to fib about," he said. "Oh, I'm sorry, it was Gareth's secret." "You don't have to keep his secrets anymore," Stubbs said. "A fingerprint here, in the blood," Spokane observed. "Well, I'm sure my fingerprints are all over the office," Dottie said, unasked for, remembering something sticky when she closed the latch. "Oh, I'm sure they are," Stubbs said, exchanging a glance with his boss. "Do you have the combination to the safe?" Spokane asked. "No," Dottie said, and meant it. Spokane said they'd have a man out to get it open, then return to Dottie's side, putting his best smile and asking her what happened after Stone showed her the jewels. "Well, he broke out a new bottle and invited me to have a drink," Dottie said. "Was that usual, drinking with Mr. Stone?" Spokane asked. Dottie resented the implication, but Spokane's smile was sunny and boyish. When it turned on her, she wanted to do whatever he wanted her to do. "No, not unusual," she said. "I didn't think about him that way." "Did he think about you that way?" Stubbs asked. "I couldn't say," Dottie said coldly. "Oh, it's not personal, Dottie," Spokane said. "We have to ask." His voice brought the sun out again. "How many drinks did you have with Mr. Stone?" Spokane asked.
"Only one. I was late to leave."
"For a date?" Stubbs asked. "Just some friends at the Mocambo," Dottie said, thinking she sounded unconvincing. "He must have tied one on after you left," Stubbs said. "The bottle was empty." "Toxicology will confirm that," Spokane said, and Dottie liked that Spokane was self-assured, in command. They finished up, and Spokane gave Dottie his card. "If you need anything at all, my number is here," Spokane said, touching Dottie's fingertips when he handed her the card. Dottie knew she'd call, but first, Frankie. Seamus was gone, and Buster was too old to hunt. Grown fat from the tuna Seamus set out, Buster's brief patrols had been a luxury, drinking water from garden sprinklers, lounging here in the sunlight atop the building, inches from the coop with its stupid fluttering birds, before he scarcely wanted to clout the birds, not even for fun. Now his stomach urged otherwise, but the birds squawked out of the way when he quested his paw between the bars. Worse than the hunger was his deepening loneliness. When you know a human, you stay with them to the end. Those are the rules. But it did nothing for the hurt, as he wasn't even supposed to know Seamus. He swore the time before would be the last time, but he went ahead and knew Seamus anyway. No more. He'd never open himself up that way again. But with Seamus, he had purpose. There was more in his life than prowling and sleeping and eating. There was knowing. Buster missed when Seamus spoke to him. The sound meant nothing, but Buster sensed they were important. Seamus would talk and talk, and then he'd halt and snap his fingers in triumph. He'd reward Buster with a scratch under the chin, then get his hat and hurry from the office. Buster's true work came when Seamus slept. Curled beside Seamus, Buster would enter Seamus's dreams, swept into a storm of fears he could not name. Buster defended, leaving the man's spirit free to soar and unravel mysteries. Only when Seamus awoke could Buster enjoy sleep of his own. Buster stiffly lowered himself down, closed his eye, and let the sun warm his bones. He folded his paws beneath his body and let his belly puddle on the tiles, so hot they almost burned. He could never get warm enough, not anymore. He drifted between worlds, trying to recall Seamus's scent. Instead, it was Hater, shooing him with her purse and smelling too strongly of rose and jasmine. Buster woke with a start, nose twitching. He still smelled rose and jasmine from many blocks away in a place it had never been before. Curiosity. Buster followed his nose in a low trot, ignoring the vacancy in his stomach and his heart. Stubbs snapped his book shut and let his eyes trace the Mocambo Club's dim outlines, a riot of South American colors, barbershop columns, and gilded potted plants. It was a midweek afternoon, and the club was less than a quarter full. The Mocambo had lost its mojo since the war. The smart crowd went to Ciro's now. Bogey and Bacall wouldn't be in. tonight or any night. Across the room he saw movement. Restless, exotic birds displayed behind glass, the club's signature feature. Maybe they were talking birds. Maybe he should interview them. They'd have as much to offer as any of the mummies that Stubbs braced in the club. Yes, they'd seen Miss Walker. She's a regular. She had drinks with several men and danced with several more. She left by herself. Times varied, but no later than midnight. Well, enough for an alibi. The club was a waste of Stubbs' time. No way a tough PI like Gareth Stone did himself in. He didn't leave a note. A Walker broad shot him or knew who did. He should be running a tail on Dottie, not checking her story. But Spokane assigned that job to himself. Of course he did. A tail on a tail was right up his alley. Would you like a drink, Lieutenant? Stubbs turned to see Miles, the bartender. No, I'm on duty. But would you like a drink? Miles repeated. Stubbs nodded and Miles set out two glasses. I never congratulated you on joining homicide, Miles said, pouring with his delicate hands. Yeah, I stopped doing the pickups, Stubbs said. Well, there's another guy now. There's always another guy. Stubbs was glad he was done with vice. The payoffs and the girls and the hopheads, all of it. They drank a second round, slower this time. You've been asking about Dottie Walker, Miles said. You know something? Yeah, I might. Stubbs put a fin on the bar. Miles didn't pick it up. For the drinks, Stubbs said. No drinks are on the house. Give it to the Sisters of Mercy, Stubbs said, pushing the fiver closer. I don't want your money, Miles said. I'd rather do you a favor. You remember favors, right? Stubbs grunted, noncommittal. Spokane can piss up a rope, but you're square, Miles said. You got something to say or not? Sure, Miles said, clearing away the drinks. She was in here last night, talking to plenty of guys. Well, glad I didn't pay for this, Stubbs said, taking back the bill. But there was one guy. New guy? Name of Frankie. Stubbs checked his book. Well, this was a new name. Dottie worked the room, but not until Frankie left. She was here for him. Well, how do you know? Because she was late and Frankie moaned about it, Miles said. Then, when she got here, they fought. Oh? About what? About who knows? You got men and women, and someone is late, and everyone's certain they can handle their liquor. I didn't see it at all. I got a job to do, right? But when I saw Frankie twist her wrist and Dottie gave him something, then he took off. What time was that? After 10, no later than 10:30. Did Miss Walker have anything to say about it? No, Miles said. She was scared. But she had every guy in here to make her feel better. What do you know about this guy, Frankie? Stubbs asked. Miles gave a description. Tall guy, a greaser, and prison fit, new in town. Yeah, he's probably got a parole officer, Stubbs said, closing his book. I'll check it out, thanks. About that favor, Miles said. Here it comes. You find Dottie, tell her that creep's no good for her, Miles said. Tell her to drop by, alone, and drinks are on me. You'll have to pry her away from Spokane first, Stubbs said. "'Twas ever thus,' Miles mused, not seeming concerned. "'Tell her.' Stubbs blew Miles a kiss and left. Ada was there, and she should not be there. This was Buster's territory, and she came from outside, filling Seamus's office with her scent before going back somewhere else. Hader was out of place, like a fountain pen atop a desk that should be on the floor. Buster knew the building. There were many cats here, including the queen who had captivated Buster's attention. She was no longer in heat, but Buster twitched at the memory. And there was a Tom who took all the food set out in the bowls together, and faster than Buster. Most cats were now. Buster prowled the building's ledge, mouth open, sorting the still potent scent from the queen's lapsed estrus, from the rose and jasmine he tracked to the limits of his range. He was distracted by a grasshopper, and then a grooming response threatened to annihilate his determination altogether. Buster's sense memory of Seamus was fading. The knowing was broken. Why was he here? Then Buster flashed on the smell from Seamus's blanket, on the old leather couch, and remembered the dreams they dreamt together. Seamus was a good man, loyal and kind. He deserved to be remembered, no matter how it hurt. Buster prowled on. Through a mostly closed window, he saw Hader and a man he did not know. "Didn't have to kill him. What do you think would happen?" The man exited into an adjoining room, Hader getting up from the bed to follow. Buster squeezed through the window and surveyed the room. The tobacco scent was strong from the smoke Hader was making, but also deep in the grooves of the bedspread and the faded paper glued to the walls. He caught a whiff of oil or gasoline. Hader's rose and jasmine scent lingered, impossible to miss. Buster should have gotten it last night, but the queen had him out of his head. Randy old fool. From the next room, glass broke, and Hader made a keening sound like Tom's ready to fight. Buster turned to the window, measuring the distance from the floor. He didn't trust the jump, especially with the window nearly closed. He wanted to run, but he couldn't run. There was something he needed to do. Buster didn't know what it was. He jumped onto the bed, landing heavily, misjudging the easy distance. Across the bed lay Hader's coat. The bed beneath was thick with a man's oily scent. A black clamshell wallet lay open on the bed, framing irresistible glass bits, round and polished. Oh, curiosity! The bits bore a trace of Seamus's scent, staggering Buster at the memory. These jewels had long been in Seamus's dreams, gleaming and always beyond his reach. They demanded Buster's touch, and they did not belong where they were. The man's voice was loud from the next room, shouting down the woman's wailing. Buster's back twitched. He eyed his window escape. He knew he should go, but the stones were so pretty, and they did not belong. He flicked at a stone, knocking it from the open wallet and onto the bed. It did not belong on the bed either, and he flicked it a second time, a third, knocking it to the wooden floor. It rolled with a fetching sound, and Buster yearned to bat it across the floor, but there were more stones in the wallet. These he scattered, with firmer swipes, spraying them across the bed. One by one, and with increasing accuracy, he knocked them to the floor. When the last landed, Buster jumped down after it, consumed with its prey. He batted a stone beneath the desk, sprinted after it. He got caught up in a rug, tumbled sideways into the desk. The stone was lost in his dignity with it. But Buster spotted another, taunting him on a bare patch of floor where the moonlight flooded in. He knocked it beneath the bed, then another and another. Buster was kittenish now, it in ways he never shared, not even with Seamus. One stone remained. Buster launched himself, landing wildly atop the jewel, shooting it under the desk, tumbling over sideways in his joy. He sat up quickly, confirming no one saw. His dignity restored, he began to groom, licking his paw and swiping it over his useless right eye. The man came into the room. The scream was what tore it. 3 years on vice with Spokane made Stubbs lax on procedures. Homicide was a fresh start, and he tried to stick to the book, but the book didn't work. The guys you needed to talk to didn't talk to cops, especially in this neighborhood. Asking after Frankie got door slammed in his face, Even when he got his foot into one, Stubbs had to chase the guy across his flop and grab him by the belt before he could go out the window. Whatever that sad sack did, it must have been bad to want to go out a two-story window, but Stubbs didn't care. Stubbs didn't do confession work much anymore, and his hands were getting soft. But he only opened one old scar before getting what he needed, an address for Frankie in a transient hotel on South Santa Fe near the tracks. He phoned it in, and Spokane said he'd come with a couple of uniforms for backup. He tried to wait, but then came the scream, and Stubbs was up the stairs and through the door, his gun out. Dottie Walker was on the floor, draped over a chair, her face in her arms. Stubbs lowered the pistol and went to her, and Frankie took him from behind. Procedure again. Stupid, not putting eyes on Frankie first. Frankie knocked Stubbs' revolver from his hand and got his arms around Stubbs' barrel chest, slamming his pomaded head against Stubbs' chin. He was prison fit, all right. 2 years in county, according to the parole officer, and it felt like all he did there was lift weights. Frankie tackled Stubbs over the chair, the two of them getting tangled with Dottie. "Get the gun, Dot!" Frankie shouted. "Get the gun!" Stubbs was on his back, Frankie raining indiscriminate blows on his head and neck. Frankie tried to break his nose. Stubbs' nose had never been broken, and besides his shoes, his nose was his only pride. No way this greaser was going to break it. Stubbs heaved Frankie off and got to his feet. Frankie scrambled back, crouched to lunge. "Stop it!" Dottie screamed, standing near the window, pointing Stubbs' revolver at Frankie, then Stubbs, then Frankie. "Shoot him, Dot!" Frankie yelled. Stubbs saw Dottie hesitate and launched into Frankie, bearing him into the next room and onto the bed, one big hand on Frankie's face and feeling for his cuffs with the other. Another procedural mistake. Dottie brained Stubbs with his own pistol. "You should have shot him," Frankie said, getting out from under Stubbs. "I'm not killing a cop," Dottie said. Frankie motioned for Dottie to give him the gun. "I might shoot you," Dottie said, holding her ground and aiming at Frankie. "Oh, baby, you're hysterical." "I'll show you hysterical," Dottie said, pointing with the gun. "Over there, against the wall." Frankie put his hands up, stepped back. "We got about 5 minutes to get this right, Dot," he said. "You give me the jewels and we can still get away." "I don't have them. They're on the bed." "The hell they are," Frankie said. "See for yourself." The wallet was open on the bed, but the jewels were gone. "No games, Dot. Cough 'em up," Frankie said. "You made me hit a cop," Dottie said, "and you killed Gareth." Frankie laughed. "Innocent little Dottie blabbing about the jewels, giving me the key to the boss's office? You twisted my wrist." "Same difference," Frankie said. "And you didn't mind when I brought the key back last night. You were real lovey-dovey." "You didn't tell me you killed him. I had to find his body. You could have warned me." Frankie was unconcerned. "Better it should be a surprise for you," Frankie said. "I was trying to keep you out of it." "But why did you kill him?" Dottie was crying now. "He was a sweet old man." "He called me a punk and said that there was time he would have taken my gun away from me," Frankie said. "The old jerk was too drunk to stand, but he still gave me lip. Well, I showed him. I made him open the safe. Then I got the rest of the whiskey down him and he was out." "You didn't have to kill him." "He saw me, baby, and I might have mentioned you. He'd remember us when he woke up, but an old guy spurned by his secretary gets hammered and shoots himself? Cops might buy it, especially with the door locked." Dottie wiped a tear, and Frankie saw his opening. He snatched the pistol from Dottie's hand and twisted her wrist, dropping her to one knee. "Now, where are the jewels, Dot?" Buster crouched beneath the bed, where he'd scurried when the man first came into the room. The game with the jewels was forgotten. With Hader and Onions and the new man all close by shouting, he tried to make himself low, eye wide and ears flat. He saw the man drag Hader into the next room, pausing to slap her face. Hader crumpled to the floor while the man raged. Buster heard glass breaking and furniture going over. He slunk from beneath the bed, as low to the ground as he could manage. Onions was atop the bed, sleeping. Buster headed for the window, judging the unfamiliar jump. The man stormed back into the room, shouting, "Run, Buster!" Buster charged across the floor and launched for the window. His head hit the frame, his front paws on the sill, his hind legs uselessly raking the wall for traction. He was half in the room, half in the window, consumed with shame and fear. He couldn't fit. He had to fit. The man was right there. He fell back to the floor, turned and saw the man was between him and the door. Buster was blind with terror. He sprinted lightning and low, screaming like a tom, squeezing past the man and into the next room. A door to one side, open, but a window to the other. Escape! He charged for the window, but Hader was there. He'd forgotten all about Hader, forgotten Seamus. Hader's sudden appearance panicked him, and he turned toward the door to escape, but the man was there, blocking his way. Instinct seized him. His claws churned across the carpet, and he launched himself toward the man. The man's hands went up, and he dropped his gun. Buster sunk his claws and teeth into the man's chest and face, trying to get away and trying to kill him all at once. The man spun around, screaming, tearing at Buster to pull him away. He staggered backwards through the door, and his heel caught. They were both tumbling down the stairs.
"Are you all right, Miss Walker?" Spokane asked. Stubbs got to one knee from the bed, rubbing his head.
"Yeah, I'm fine, Captain, thanks," Stubbs said to himself. Spokane wouldn't have heard in any case, intent as he was on consoling Dottie.
Stubbs stood and took his revolver from where Frankie had dropped it. He holstered it, not eager to explain how a suspect had taken it from him. There'd be time enough later to sort out Dottie's culpability in the whole affair. To judge by Spokane's arm around Dottie's shoulders, the captain was ready to give her the benefit of the doubt.
Stubbs arched his back, bent down to get his hat from the floor near the foot of the bed when he saw a jewel on the floor.
But he was done. Leave it for Spokane. He'd take the credit anyway.
Stubbs left the apartment, went down the stairs, stepping over Frankie where he was sprawled at the bottom, his neck broken. One of Spokane's uniformed officers was out front, dispelling the crowd already gathering on the street. Stubbs bowled through them and went around the side of the building. He leaned against the wall, fished a bent Lucky Strike from his coat pocket, struck a match, and took a blessed drag. He rubbed the back of his head, and his hand came away wet with blood from where Dottie hit him. What a day! He caught movement from the corner of his eye. "What the heck?" he said, and hand leaping to his revolver. A familiar cat sat in a pool of moonlight. "What are you doing on this side of town, cat?" Stubbs said, relieved. He squatted down where he stood, several feet from the cat. "You make tracks all the way out here? You got some grit." He saw the cat's dirty and tangled fur, the grime over his mangled eye. "You're a mess, Puss-Puss. Looked like you went the distance with Rocky Marciano." He patted his pockets for treats, finding nothing, then held out his hand gently and without expectation. He moved his fingers in silent, snapping motions, making quiet clicking sounds with his tongue against his teeth. Buster's heart stopped. Did Onions know? He made the supplicating gesture and the right sounds. Buster didn't want another human. Couldn't hurt like that again. Onions wiggled his fingers. His eyes were soft. Almost, against his will, Buster stretched, front paws parallel and forward, spine tracing an inverted arch from his shoulders to the base of his upthrust tail. Then he sat, just out of reach. "Puss-puss." Buster slitted his eye, indifferent.
He smelled the metal smell from the back of Onion's head. There was a man who needed defending. Onions made his clicking sound. He watched Buster patiently. He knows. Well, crap. Buster stood, his will not his own. He walked a figure eight through Onion's ankles and scared steps, then flipped on his back to bare his belly. Onions touched his stomach, and Buster swatted him, claws out enough to make clear who was in charge. He presented his chin for scratching. Seamus would understand. Seamus would want this. But this was the last time. All right, I'm off to a different Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine story by Marilyn Todd, and it's called The Tatton Hall Tontine. The Beatles were belting through the speakers loud enough to bend the walls, urging everyone to get back to where they once belonged. Tony didn't hear. He didn't notice groovy girls wafting around with false eyelashes longer than their miniskirts, much less care what Judy Garland had just died. His focus was on the heap of pound notes on the table and the 3/8, the king and the six in his hand. Winner takes all. That's how it had always been with the Tatton Hill Tearaways, meaning there was more at stake here than just poker. Or Tony having his shiny triumph herald repossessed. 3/8, a king, and a six. I'll see you 5 pounds and raise you 5 pounds more. 1/5 of his week's pay packet, but oh, what the heck. This was a winning hand, and that's what it was all about. Winning. Yep, I'm out, Dave slapped his cards face down. Rob had already bailed. Vince spiked his long, dark George Harrison hair out of his face with resignation. Yeah, me too. Good, that just left him and Ken slugging it out, and there was no point trying to read his opponent for tells. Oh, these boys had all grown up in the same run-down back-to-backs in London's East End's Tatton Hall, where dark, satanic mills were closing by the day thanks to the surge of Taiwanese sweatshops. They'd all attended the same class in junior school, gathering the same grazed knees, black eyes, and missing caps before trooping next door to the secondary modern, where they'd kick the heck out of a football the minute the bell went, and, whenever the opportunity arose, pupils from the nearby grammar school. Right from the start, every game was competitive, every score kept. From marbles to conkers, each kid vied to be top dog, even if it came down to who did Mr. Warren cane the most this week. Vince? The others had an obligation to outdo him. So if Billy got caned more times the week after, how could they take up the stakes and earn that extra whack? Tony's legs still had the scars, but that's how it was back then, and that's how it was now. Only instead of getting caned, it was who got laid the most. No scars from that then. Dave reckoned rivalry ran through their veins. Tony called him a square for even thinking it. This was survival of the fittest man, winner takes all, no matter how small or petty the challenge. I'll take your fiver, Tony Barnes, and raise you 10. Ken was bluffing, but by God, was Tony going to make him sweat. As the Rolling Stones rocked the roof tiles and rattled the pint mugs behind the bar, where the third brawl of the night was already breaking out, he pretended to consider his hand, thinking back to how, once they left school, the dynamics changed. For one thing, Joe put some chick in a family way, then did what any self-respecting father-to-be would do, went off to join the Navy. Ray was taken on as an engineering apprentice in Manchester. Billy's family took assisted passage to Australia, while Doogie, poor bugger, was killed in a hit and run. Which left just him, Ken, Dave, Rob, and Vince to throw their earnings down their throats on a Saturday night and chat up the Dollybirds. Waiting for Kenny to fold, he thought back to when they'd sit around the table, this table as it happened, filling in the football coupons, trying to predict the outcome of Saturday's matches. Despite being just the five of them, they still formed a syndicate the same way people did on the factory floor or in shops, only theirs was different. Survival of the fittest again. Whoever got the lowest prediction rate bought the drinks. It was a gas, though. You'd pick a dozen or so matches out of 60-odd and then decide whether it was a win, lose, or draw. That grid was bloody complex, mind. For one thing, the bookies differentiated between home and away wins. So to maximize your chances, you'd fill in what's called full perm entries, putting a cross against every possible combination of 8 matches, selecting from the total and entered as a single line. Okay, it cost, 40, 50 times the cost of a single line? But so what? Like roast beef on Sunday, doing the pool was a British tradition. Name someone who didn't fill them in. Most posted them off, but the Tottenhall boys would meet in the pub to fill out the coupons before the agents from Vernon's Pools came to relieve them of their entry fee. Rough as the 3 tons was, it beat cramping up in Rob's mum's living room, listening to his dad wheeze on the oxygen machine that kept him, barely, alive, or have Kenny's stepfather lecturing them on the evils of gambling. Gambling? It was only a few quid apiece, but no, Ken's stepdad wasn't having any of that. Mug's game, he'd snort. Like drinking a bottle of scotch every night wasn't, or beating the crap out of Ken's mom was a virtue. Come 5 o'clock Saturday, they'd cluster around Tony's transistor, hearts in their mouths as the results were announced. And the roars that went up if they won a fiver were deafening. Every blue-collar worker's dream, winning the pools. And the time, bloody hell, when they won a pony, 25 bleeding quid? Far out, man. The pub landlord made a tidy profit that night. I'll take your tenner and raise you 10, Tony said. Not only would these 3 8s keep his Triumph Herald out of the bailiff's hands, he could trade it in for that bright blue Ford Cortina he'd had an eye on for a while. Across the table, Kenny's face made a door frame look expressive. No change there, then, leaving Tony thinking about the day the telegram arrived. Telegram, for God's sake, they don't send them out for a pony. $100,000? £93,863, to be precise, but close enough, and 2 fingers to Kenny's bastard stepdad. What are you going to do with it, lads? The press descended faster than lightning. Suddenly everyone wanted an interview. Well, 20,000 each. What's your plans? National press, local rags. At this rate, Tattenhall Terrace could be more famous than Coronation Street. They'd be all over the front pages like Bobby Moore when he lifted the World Cup. You gonna do a Viv Nicholson? Viv Nicholson was a woman who famously announced that she'd spend after her husband won over $150,000. And by goodness sakes, did she. Fur coats, sport cars, foreign holidays, you name it. More jewelry her than in Tiffany's. No way, Vince piped up. Fat lot of good that did her. True. Not only did she blow the whole lot in a couple of years, her husband died shortly afterwards, crashing one of their fancy cars at high speed and straddling her with a boatload of debt. Anyway, we don't divvy up, do we, boys? Vince was in his stride by then. Not our style. Tony remembered how they'd all slapped each other's shoulders in agreement, blinded by flashbulbs, excitement, hard liquor, and fame. Which probably explained what happened next. And since none of us is 21 yet, he blurted out, blimey, we don't even have the vote. We're tying the whole lot up till we're 30 for when we're settled down and married. Would Tony have said that if he hadn't been dropped down drunk? Would the others have cheered him on, or if they weren't equally legless? Of course not. But, at the time, he'd been quoting his gran, who'd said something along the lines of, for goodness sake, stick it in the bank until you little toe rags have grown the heck up and learn how to bloody well share. Well, that was 3 years ago. But even after they'd sobered up and the shooting of three plainclothes coppers pushed them off the headlines, all agreed it was the right call to make. Out loud and to anyone who'd listen, they'd make it quite clear that they weren't ready to be householders yet, even though you could get a right posh house for $5,000. In truth, each knew it would be the end of an era. No more high-spirited larks, no winner-takes-all, no edge to the game anymore. Thoughts like that, though, you keep to yourself. So to the world, to each other, hell, even to themselves. This was the age of Aquarius, man. Life was for living, not settling down. And for bright blue cortinas. Well, after this hand. Across the table, Kenny leaned back in his chair. Tony could already feel his fingers closing over the keys in the palm of his hand. Heard the engine throb as his foot hit the pedal. Half reached to turn up the radio to set Proud Mary blaring on Max down Tattenhall Street. I'll call. Kenny drew down three jacks and a pair. And while you get the drinks in, Tone, I will be deciding what I'm going to do with this pot. 3 months later, same time, same place, only there were four, not five, at the table, and not a deck of cards to be seen. In those few short weeks, the world had wobbled on its axis. Woodstock had come and gone. Beatlemania had peaked. Men walked on the moon. Sharon Tate was murdered. Ted Kennedy left a girl to die in Chappaquiddick. All of which paled in significance. To Ken. Ken. Who could possibly have seen that coming? Kenny, of all people, running a hose pipe into the back of his car? When Doogie died, it was a shock. But they were only kids back then. You don't process things the way you do later. You don't feel other people's pain. You only know how it affects you. Ken's death jerked the rug right from under them, and the funeral rammed at home. Even his stepdad shed a tear. But what ripped the boys up inside was realizing, oh man, they didn't really know their friend. Okay, you could argue that poker player to the end. Kenny was always going to keep his gambling habit secret. Even so, how could he have run up such a debt with a loan sharks that no one had so much as a clue? or that he'd have no chance of paying it off, because those gorillas don't take IOUs for when a bloke turns 30 and his share of the jackpot's released. This time, Sweet Caroline bent the walls, but the boys didn't hear. They'd have gone through the whole woulda, coulda, shoulda thing until they were blue in the face, but it didn't change one darn thing. Kenny was gone. Everyone's a loser. Wasn't it Frank Sinatra who sang about regrets and seeing them through? Tony hated that song. Got right up his nose, it did, even more because his gran would keep playing it over and over, but he reckoned old Blue Eyes had a point, 'cause Tony did have regrets, and let's face it, this was all his fault. Beggars can't be choosers, as they say, but then again, winners can't be losers. After such soul-searching, he finally saw how to put things right. What's more, he would do it his way. Blimey, Vince rolled his eyes as he laughed. I haven't been here since we was, what, 12? 13? Yeah, me neither. Tony leaned his elbows on the bridge, staring at the railway lines gleaming in the sun. Steam engines in them days. Vince's voice was wistful. And why not? The whistle, the chug, the hiss, the smoke. A massive part of their childhood. That, because down there's where the Tattenhall Tearaways used to line up, right there behind them bushes. Then, at the whistle, race to see who could hop the train first when it came out of the tunnel. The milk train, Tony said. All the trains on this line back then were good trains, but it had to be the first of the day, when more often than not it was still dark, because once they'd hitch a ride down to the docks at Tilbury, they'd have to hop another back and be at school in time not to earn a detention. Remember when the conductor saw Billy and waved his fist? Without knowing the rest of us was already on board, Tony nodded. And the time Davy slipped and sprained his ankle, swelled up like a balloon it did. But we left him behind all the same. Hey, no choice, Tone. Which reminds me of Doogie. Didn't Half use his elbows to push us out of the way? Tell me about it. I got the bruises. He won most times, though. Always joking about when push comes to shove, elbows always win. Vince spiked his George Harrison hair out of his eyes. So come on, now what's all this about? What are we doing here? This. Tony brought out a small brown envelope from his pants pocket. The others will be along any second, but I thought this would be a fab way to honor Kenny. Scatter his ashes on the line. What? You got some of Ken in there? Well, not him personally. I burned the sleeves of his favorite LP and thought we could all gather here and scatter that. Abbey Road? Whoa, far out, man. That spot, there. That's where I thought we could drop him. Steady, mate, don't lean it over too far. Safe as houses, Vince. But see that little ledge? Most of the ash'll blow right away in the wind. But play it right? Yeah, I reckon some of it'll hang around a bit. Maybe catch the milk train in the morning. He glanced at his watch. The express would be coming thundering through in half a minute. Well, I don't see no ledge. Oh, yeah, you do. Just there. Tony leaned over further and pointed. Knew I should have brought a pair of them Cuban heels like you, Vince stretched. Where? There. Tony smiled. This time, he'd played his hand right. The others weren't coming. It was crushed leaves in the envelope. The train driver would be able to confirm afterwards that he saw the long-haired one topple over while the other one tried to save him. But because he was only half his weight, he couldn't hold him, poor bugger. Survival of the fittest. Winner takes all. $100,000 all, to be precise. When push comes to shove, as Doogie would say, and now, with Vince gone, that only left Rob and Dave, and, hey, accidents happen. Vince pitched forward into the path of the oncoming express. Panic-stricken hands flailed, clawing at whatever they could find. They clawed at the jacket. Tony's soft new leather jacket. The grip was stronger than iron. The screams as they plunged down together haunted the train driver for the rest of his life. All right, folks, that's going to do it for this episode of the Mystery Hour, and I am Keith Towler saying thank you so very much for tuning in to this show here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Tune in again next time, would you please? Thanks. Make sure your I love yous are in order. So long.